Blog Talk Radio.
Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains against chronic disease. Thousands die yearly due to drug reactions. What can be done? Thomas Edison is quoted as declaring, "The doctor of the future will give no medicine, but interest his patients in diet and nutrition, exercise, and the care of the human frame. He will teach them about the cause of all disease." The doctors of the future are here. Welcome to Phase 3 Wellness with your host, Keith Henry, MD, one of the doctors of the future.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining me. This is Dr. Keith Henry, broadcasting here from Orlando, Florida, and welcome to the Phase 3 Wellness podcast. I think I'm having a little bit of technical difficulties here. I'm not quite sure, but again, thank you for joining me this afternoon on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm broadcasting from Orlando, Florida area. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry, and we indeed have a fascinating and insightful show for you today. Now, we will be looking at three articles today. Normally, we look at two or three in our first segment called the Week in Natural News Review segment. And we're going to be talking about three exciting articles. And the first one we're going to be talking about is an article that I found on AmericanScientific.com. And it's entitled, "How Dad's Stresses Get Passed Along to their offspring. And so this is amazing. It's an amazing study that came out. We'll also be talking about the McRib sandwich, if you will. McRib, but it's a sandwich by, the second article is talking about, it's the sandwich by McDonald's. And this article talked about, it was from healthy-holistic-living.com. This article will talk about how the sandwich only is supposed to have basically four ingredients, but the article went on to point out how it actually has about 70 ingredients. Many of them are cancer promoting, according to the article. So we'll be looking at that as well. Also, we'll be looking at an article dealing with sleep. Now, we've talked about sleep before and how sleep affects the brain in terms of being able to your brain detoxing while you're sleeping. This is another article from Dr. Marcola, and the article is entitled, "It is like injecting your brain with poison, yet 63% of people do it." So basically, this is him talking about us being involved in sleep deprivation, how sleep deprivation is very, very detrimental to our brains. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry, and we're going to try and go ahead and get started here. I hope that my, I think I may be having a couple of issues here. I can't hear through my headset, so I'm not quite sure if you've been able to hear me. And so, yeah. We're going to go ahead and get started, though. Hopefully, you can hear me so I won't have to redo this broadcast. So we're going to go ahead and get started with our first article. Again, the first article is how stressors can be passed off from the father to the offspring. Now, before we get into that, I just also want to mention that we, in our Healing Foods segment, in our Healing Food segment, we will be talking briefly a little bit about mangoes. And in our Healing Herb segment, we'll be talking about lavender, the herb lavender. And so we'll do those in our second and third segment. So we're going to go ahead and get started. Again, you're listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry, and thank you for listening. So let's get started. Okay, our first article again is from scientificamerican.com, and it's by Esther Lauders. And again, this article is talking about how dad stresses get passed along to offspring. How dad stresses gets passed along to offspring. And again, the article goes on to say, it says a stressed out and traumatized father can leave scars in his children. It says new research suggests this happens because sperm, quotes, learn paternal experiences via a mysterious mode of intercellular communication in which small blebs break off one cell and fuse with another. Interesting. So it's saying that the article is pointing out how men, fathers, can basically through rough stresses, intense stresses, or just stresses in general, can actually basically cause a process, if you will, in their bodies that will affect or that can affect their offspring. The article goes on to say further that carrying proteins, lipids, and nucleic acids, these particles ejected from a cell act like a postal system that extends to all parts of the body, releasing little packages known as extracellular vessels. Their contents seem carefully chosen. It says the cargo inside the vessel determines not just where it came from, but where it's going and what it's doing when it gets there, says Tracy Bell, a neurobiologist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. So basically, they're beginning to find out that men who have a stressed out or traumatized can pass these experiences via their genetics to their offspring. The article says further, preliminary research, Bell and others announced this week at the annual meeting of the Society of Neuroscience in San Diego, shows how extracellular vessels can regulate brain circuits and help diagnose neurodegenerative diseases, in addition to altering sperm to disrupt the brain health of resulting offspring. So it's amazing that they're basically pointing out how this stress and these extracellular vessels can actually regulate brain circuits and help diagnose neurodegenerative diseases, in addition to altering sperm to disrupt the brain health of resulting offspring. So not only is the science helping them to understand how to regulate and diagnose neurodegenerative diseases, it's also helping them to understand how altering sperm can disrupt the brain of the father's offspring. The article says further, striking evidence that harsh conditions affect a man's children came from crop failures and war ravaged Europe more than a century ago. So basically they're saying that they had some evidence more than 100 years ago that this occurred. And the article said that those unplanned human experiments, prolonged famine appeared to set off a host of health changes in future generations, including higher cholesterol levels and increased rates of obesity and diabetes. To probe the inheritance of such changes at the cellular level, Dr. Bell and her and co-workers performed a series of mouse experiments. And they point out in the article how it's relatively pretty easy to stress out a mouse. And again, I'm not advocating animal torture or animal using animals to hurt them in any way. I'm just pointing out this is what they did in the study. This is what they used in the study. And they go on to point out that by sticking a mouse in a tube that it cannot wiggle out of, or by soaking its bedding, or by blasting white noise, it said the stress levels of this mouse will shoot up as much as they do in people worrying about finances or facing incessant pressure at work. The article said, remarkably, the way mouse physiologically responds to stress looks noticeably different. If months before conception, its father endured a period of stress. So at least in these mouse studies as well, they found out that if months before conception, the father of the mouse endured a period of stress, the way that the offspring responded was very noticeably different. The article says somehow their brain developed differently than if their dad hadn't experienced that stress, says Chris Morgan, a postdoc in Bell's lab who helped create the mouse model. The article went on to say the big question is how information about the paternal environment reaches the womb in the first place. After all, Morgan says, the dad is only in there for one night, perhaps just a few hours. Could this sperm carry memories of prior trauma? He asked. The article says the idea seemed reasonable yet controversial. Because DNA is packed so tightly in the nucleus of a sperm cell, the thought that the cell would respond to anything in the environment really boggled people's minds. Quoting, says Jennifer Chan, a former PhD student in Bell's lab, who's now a postdoc at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Rather, there must be some other kind of cell whose DNA does react to environmental changes, they theorize, and that cell, she reasoned, could then relay that information to sperm cells to transmit at fertilization. She focused on a population of cells that interact with developing sperm by releasing molecules that help sperm grow and mature. They also secrete extracellular vessels, and Chan showed it is these vessels whose contents fuse with sperm cells, instilling memories of the dad's prior stress. So the body being, again, fearfully and wonderfully made by the creator, as we find more and more out about how it works, we're finding out, we've talked about how the diet, we've talked about how the diet can alter the expression of the genes. We've talked about how overall lifestyle can alter the expression of the genes. And now we're seeing that the father, if he's under significant stress for a period of time, that he can pass those, the way that he can basically pass this, it can affect the brains of his offspring when it comes to their dealing with stress, because apparently the body remembered those stressors and passed them off, left those indications in the DNA and in the genes. The article went on to say further, that in one set of experiments, Chan stressed a group of male mice, let them mate, and looked at stress responses in the pups. The clincher was a set of in vitro fertilization-like experiments in which she collected sperm from a male mouse that had never experienced induced stress. Half his sperm went into a lab dish with vessels previously exposed to stress hormones. The other half was cultured with vessels that had no contact with stress hormones. Chan injected sperm cells from each batch into eggs from a non-stressed female, then implanted the fertilized eggs, zygotes, in the same foster mom. The pups from the non-stress zygotes developed normally. Pups from stress-exposed zygotes, however, showed the same abnormal stress response as those whose dad had experienced stress before mating. That showed extracellular vessels act as a conduit for transmitting paternal stress signals to the offspring, Chan says. They went on to point out further that the findings are novel and of very high impact, especially when we consider the impact of military service or other work environments for high stress, said Robert Risman, a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego, who was not involved within this particular research. He said, I think it would be important, and I'm quoting him now, to better understand the specificity of the effect and how different types of stresses or strength of stresses can modulate this system. The article says further, as a first step toward translating the findings to people, Morgan is collaborating with the University of Pennsylvania psychiatrist Neil Epperson to track protein and RNA changes in human sperm samples. At the neuroscience meeting, Morgan presented data from a six-month study of 20 undergraduate and graduate students. Each month, the participants came in and gave a sperm donation. They also completed a same-day survey asking how stressed they were feeling. Preliminary data suggests several months after a student reports stress, his sperm shows changes in small non-coding RNAs. RNA molecules that do not get translated to protein, but instead control which genes get turned on or off. Again, we've talked about that before. So here we're seeing the same capacity of the cells to basically alter the body to alter the mind or the brain based upon the stressors of the father. We know that to be similar to either parent being able to affect the child as a result of genetic. But here there's something new that stresses the father can be under significant stress months prior to perhaps having intercourse and the resulting action being his wife getting pregnant or his partner getting pregnant, and that those tendencies are altering the brain of the offspring of that father simply because he was severely stressed out and maybe not dealing with stress in the best way. The article went on to say further that analyzing sperm from this group of healthy young men, the researchers plan to build a basic understanding of molecular changes linked with mild stresses such as taking final exams. In the future, Dr. Bell and colleagues hope to compare these baseline fluctuations with changes induced by more prolonged life stresses such as post-traumatic stress disorder or neurological diseases such as autism and schizophrenia. The molecular signatures in extracellular vessels may also help researchers discover, the article says, new ways to non-invasively diagnose or predict adverse health outcomes in offsprings, pointed out Gerline Metz, who studies transgenerational inheritance of stress responses at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta and was not involved in this research either. If so, the vessels, the article went on to say, could become the ways that these stresses are being planted or transplanted from the father to the offspring. Fascinating study, fascinating article. When we look and we consider that when we deciding on whether or not to have children, our overall health, our mental health, our ability to deal or lack thereof with stress, our physical health, our spiritual health, it all ties in and it will affect our offspring for good or for evil. So again, remember that when we talk about the health, wellness, health and wellness, as I've said on here many times before, is not just physical. It's physical, mental, spiritual, emotional. And not only are you affected, but you can affect your children, your offspring, while they're yet in the womb, or even before they become in the womb. As we are seeing here, if the father was stressing 6 months before, and then as a result, he gets his wife pregnant, and now the child can be affected by, can be negatively affected by the father's stress levels. You are listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. Thank you for joining me. It's Sunday afternoon. We're going to move to our next article. We're still in our Week in Natural News Review segment. I think I was concerned a little bit earlier about my microphone working, and I think it's working well now. So we're going to go ahead and move to the next article. And the article is from healthy-holistic-living.com. And this is... again, titled The 70-Ingredient Cancer Promoting McRib Sandwich. It's not real food. Again, this came out this week. And the article points out how if you visit McDonald's often, maybe you should reconsider. And they talk about the fantastic marketing of McDonald's and says, thanks to their amazing marketing strategy, their McRib sandwich has gathered an enormous following. It said, the article says, quote, McRib was originally introduced in 1981 to their special menu and has been a menu item off and on since. It has made a comeback and reached superb popularity in 2013. But the article says the trouble is that McRib contains over 70 ingredients. And then it asks the question, why is this troubling? Because McRib is supposed to be a bun, a barbecue patty, pickles, and onion. That's four ingredients, not 70. And so they ask the question, where is the rest coming from? And what does it do to your body? Then they quote McDonald's website, or they refer to McDonald's website, and they say, according to McDonald's website, the list of ingredients include the McRib pork patty. Ingredients: pork, water, salt, dextrose, preservatives, BHA, propylgalate and citric acid. They go into the article, says in the pork you can't find quality meat either. It's all restructured meat from the insides of pigs, including their heart, tripe, and scalded stomach, cooked and processed. The processing removed all salt, soluble protein, and congeals, creating a rubbery patty that seems like the real thing. It says it also includes propylgalate and BHA, which are preservatives that can lead to thyroid, urinary, and bladder carcinogenesis, or cancer-causing substances, stomach hyperplasia, and cytotoxicity. And that's just the patty. And then they go on to break down the ingredients contained in the bun used with the McRib. And it basically says that the ingredients are enriched flour, bleached white flour, malted barley flour, niacin, reduced iron, thiamine, I'm not going to list all of them, but ammonium sulfate, soy flour dough conditioners, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then it says, and it goes into some other preservatives, very, very, very long list. And then it goes on to say further, aside containing wheat and soy, which are common allergens for some people, they are filled with high fructose. The buns are filled with high fructose corn syrup that can lead to pancreatic cancer and other health issues. It also has ammonium and calcium sulfate, which is also used as a soil fertilizer, and many, many, many other chemically based substances that have been added here. And one of the chemicals the article points out that's used as a dough conditioner is also used to manufacture foam plastic and is banned in Europe and Australia. And then it goes on to talk about the sauce that's used in the McRib. And, of course, I won't read all of the ingredients because there's so many. It's over 70 ingredients in it when you look at everything that's included. But it includes high fructose corn syrup also in the sauce, distilled vinegar, and sodium benzoate. Which is a preservative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the pickle slices, it talks about the ingredients that are in the pickle slices, including a number of preservatives, et cetera. And so it's over 70 different pieces of ingredients that's in when you look at the bread, the and one of the astonishing things is the patty. You know, it's where they're taking basically using the internals of the pig, which is itself an unclean animal to be eating at all. And the article goes on to point out even the pickle is not a pickle, but contains potassium sorbate, which is a genotoxic and mutagenic compound among other ingredients. So basically, the article basically just pointed out how not only are there all kinds of chemicals and carcinogenic chemicals added to this so-called food, but there's more than 70 ingredient cancer-promoting ingredients in this, what they call cancer-promoting McRib sandwich. In other words, it basically boils down in the point of the article that it's not real food, and that if you visit McDonald's on a consistent basis or a regular basis, and you're eating that on a regular basis, or any fast food joint, really, you're substantially increasing the likelihood that you're going to develop diabetes, cancer, high cholesterol, and any other number of diseases. So again, if you're going to significantly increase the likelihood. So again, if you are interested in your health and wellness and the health and wellness of your family and even of your offspring, if you're still in that stage of life where you're producing offspring, just understand, as we talked about in our first article, what you put in your body, the way you deal with stress, how you live, is going to cause issues. It can cause issues in your genes. It can turn the expression of certain genes on and off, and that can affect your offspring. And you don't want to do anything that's going to make it any more difficult for them to have wellness of mind and body than it's already going. You don't want to make it any more difficult for them than it's already going to be. Now, again, you're listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We're still in our first segment, the Week in Natural News Review segment. And thank you for joining me. We're going to go to our third and final article in this segment before we move to our Healing Food segment and to our Healing Herb segment. But the final article in this segment is an article from Marcola.com. And it's entitled, "It is like injecting your brain with poison, yet 63% of people do it." And just for, if you hadn't listened before, just so you know, the first segment I take every week, I take out a few articles that I found interesting and I thought that would be interesting and beneficial for my listeners, and basically analyze and talk about them, give my thoughts on them a little bit. And so this is what we do in the Week in Natural News Review segment. And then we move on to the Healing Food segment, which I take a particular, you know, some food or whatnot, a fruit or a vegetable typically, and talk about some of the benefits of that fruit or vegetable that we can get by consuming or eating that fruit or vegetable. And finally, in the final segment, the Healing Herb segment, I choose an herb and talk about some of the benefits of a herb and how we can use, or a supplement, and talk about how we can use that for our health. So let's get into this article a little bit. Again, it is entitled "It Is Like Injecting Your Brain with Poison," yet 63% of people do it. And basically, this article talks about, it's by Dr. Joseph Marcola, and basically it talks about some of the damaging things that can happen to the body when we don't get enough sleep. Now, you've heard me talking here before about sleep and the benefit, how your brain detoxifies while you sleep. This article is also talking about the benefit of sleep and also talking about some of the things that can happen when we don't get enough sleep. He starts off by looking at the story at a glance, and basically he's going to talk about how healthy sleep consists of several stages. Getting less than 6 hours of sleep in any given 24-hour period will leave you cognitively impaired. Polls show that 63% of people do not get enough sleep to be healthy. 69% struggle with frequent sleep problems, and 22% are so sleepy during the day that it affects their quality of life. And sleep deprivation costs the U.S. economy $411 billion each year in accidents and lost productivity, equivalent to 2.28% of the gross domestic product. That's very significant. So let's jump into this article. And first, he talks about, Dr. Mercola talks about some of the results that sleep deprivation can have when it comes to driving. And then basically it says, according to the American Sleep Association, nearly 40% of people report unintentionally falling asleep during the day at least once a month. And nearly 5% have nodded off while driving. Most people skimp on sleep because they feel they have to get things done, he says. However, the evidence clearly shows that what you end up with is the complete opposite of productivity. Sleep deprivation is actually costing the U.S. economy $411 billion each year in accidents and in lost productivity, an amount equivalent, he says, to 2.28% of the gross domestic product, which is an estimated 1.2 million working days. It says that an estimated 1.2 million working days are also lost. And then he goes on to point out how in worst-case scenarios, there are people are killed because someone is driving a tank or a car and they fall asleep, and as a result, they kill people. And the result was, or the cause, rather, was them being severely deprived of sleep. Dr. Mercola says that polls show that 63% of people do not get enough sleep to be healthy. 69% struggle with frequent sleep problems, as I said earlier. And 22% are so sleepy during the day, it affects their quality of life. And then he begins to go into how much sleep we need. And he says, basically, research by Eve Van Carter, director of the Sleep Metabolism and Health Center at the University of Chicago, shows that sleeping less than 6 hours a night dramatically increases your risk of insulin resistance, which is at the core of most chronic diseases. So again, insulin resistance, become pre-diabetic, with diabetes being one of the diseases, but he talks about how insulin resistance is at the core of most chronic diseases. So if you're getting sleep less than 6 hours a night, dramatically increases your risk of insulin resistance. He says further, as noted in Sleep of Science, research conducted in the 1980s discovered that depriving mice of sleep for 17 days straight led to certain deaths. Two contributing causes were immune system breakdown and blood poisoning. Wow, imagine that. So not getting enough sleep over a long amount of time can actually lead to the breakdown of our immune system and also blood poisoning. Then he goes on to point out how lack of sleep can age our hearts. He says, studies have linked poor sleep with a variety of health problems, including excessive aging of your heart. He says, people who get 7 hours of sleep each night had hearts showing signs of being 3.7 years older based on biological age than their chronological age. So that's that people getting 7 hours of sleep a night. Some people say, well, I can function off 6 hours or 5 hours or 7 hours. You may actually be able to function, but is it? What type of damage, maybe subclinical damage, or maybe not, some of it not even subclinical damage, is being done to your heart. He says people who regularly slept either 6 or 8 hours had hearts that were on average 4.5 years older than their chronological age, while those who got just 5 hours or less of sleep each night had the oldest biological heart age, 5.1 years older than their chronological age. So the oldest, if you were 35, the heart of your age, they were able to determine in the study you were actually 40. And so that's significantly, that's a 5 years. That could be 5 years that we're cutting off of our lives. He also cites Lee Arthur Kwanje Yang, a senior scientist in the Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says, quote, the difference between a person's estimated heart age and his or her chronological age is excess heart age. Higher excess heart age indicates a higher risk of developing heart disease. For example, if a 40-year-old man has a heart age of 44 years based on his cardiovascular risk profile, the personal risk of having heart disease, then his excess heart age is 4 years. In effect, his heart is 4 years older than it should be for a typical man his age. The concept of heart age helps to simplify risk communication. Of the 12,755 participants in this study that was conducted by Dr. Kwan Yang, a senior scientist in the Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 13% slept 5 hours or less per night, 24% got 6 hours, 31% got 7 hours, 26% slept for 8, and about 5% got 9 or more hours of sleep each night. Considering an ideal sleep time is between 7 and 9 hours, these statistics reveal at least 37% of American adults aren't getting anywhere near healthy amounts of sleep. So again, I found personally that 8 hours of sleep for me is ideal. 7 I can function, but I can function okay. 9 is a bit too much for me, but 8. So this is consistent with the study. Between 7 and 9 hours. Some people may be able to function a little bit better on 7 than myself, but I found that 8 hours is ideal. 9 is a bit too much. Now, he also points out in his article how sleep quality, notice the sleep, the quality of the sleep, also affects blood pressure and heart disease. The article says, other recent research strengthens the link between sleep problems and heart disease. While this link has been previously noted, recent research found that even if you sleep a healthy number of hours, the quality of that sleep can have a significant impact on your risk for high blood pressure and vascular inflammation associated with heart disease. So again, it's not only the amount of sleep that we're getting, but also the quality of that sleep. And it's because if you really think about it, if the quality is not good, then the amount itself really could be inconsequential. Because if I'm sleeping and I'm sleeping for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes and I'm waking up and sleeping again and waking up, that's not good quality sleep. Although I might have, you know, cumulatively slept 7 hours, if the sleep was interrupted, if it was not a healthy sleep, if I was not going through all of the processes of sleep, then I'm still not getting the benefit of that sleep. The article went on to say further, women who had mild sleep disturbance, such as taking longer to fall asleep or waking up one or more times in the night, were significantly more likely to have high blood pressure than those who fell asleep quickly and slept soundly. In fact, Forbes magazine, this article cites, reports, according to the researchers, that, quote, systolic blood pressure, that's the top number, was associated directly with poor sleep quality, and diastolic blood pressure was a borderline significance with obstructive sleep apnea risk after adjusting for confounders. Poor sleep quality was associated with endolithia and nuclear factor kappa B activation. Insomnia and longer sleep onset latency were also associated with endolithia nuclear factor kappa B activation. So I don't want to get into too technical. I don't want to get too technical here in this quote, but basically it says these findings provide direct evidence that common but frequently neglected sleep disturbances such as poor sleep quality and insomnia are associated with increased blood pressure and vascular inflammation, even in the absence of inadequate sleep duration in women. So again, blood pressure issues are associated with not getting not only enough quantity of sleep, but also quality. Vascular inflammation, which is going to lead or can lead to heart disease, and it's just so important to get the right amount of sleep. Now, as he points out, as Dr. Mercola points out in this article, that I referred to it briefly a moment ago, but sleep is not a single state. Healthy sleep actually consists of several stages, each stage lasting about 5 to 15 minutes in a complete cycle. So there's light, deep, and rapid eye movement or REM sleep taking about between 90 and 120 minutes. And so as he points out in this article, a full sleep cycle starts out in light sleep and progresses through to eventually to deep sleep, and then it reverses back from deep to light sleep before entering what they call REM or rapid eye movement. So you cycle through each of these stages 4 to 5 times during the night, and this cycling is tremendously, he points out, important from both the biological and a physiological perspective. So let's look at these stages really briefly. Stage one and two, light sleep, which is non-REM, non-rapid eye movement sleep. During this initial stage of sleep, biological processes in your body begin to slow down. Your brain rate, your brain remains active as it begins the editing process where decisions are made about which memories to store and which to discard. So again, the Creator has made our body, and our bodies are fearfully and wonderfully made. So even the sleep is has an organized pattern in which it, with quality sleep, has an organized pattern in which it follows. So that again, that's in stage one and two. Stages three and four, deep sleep, the non-REM sleep, and in these deeper stages of sleep, as the article points out as well, you enter into a near coma-like state during which physiological cleansing and detoxification processes in the brain take place. As we're talking about one of the other reasons I said in previous podcasts, one of the other reasons why it's very important to get sufficient sleep is that the brain detoxifies and cleanses itself during that time. He points out as further in this article that your brain cells actually shrink about 60% during this deep sleep phase, and this creates more space in between the cells, giving your cerebrospinal fluid more space to flush out the debris. Then stage five, which is REM sleep. During this last phase, you enter rapid eye movement. This is what the REM stands for, where dreaming takes place. In this phase, your brain is as active as it when you're awake, during your wakeful hours. But your body is paralyzed, which prevents you from acting out your dreams. So, and he points out, he says, quote, "The frightening experience of sleep paralysis occurs when you awaken during this phase and find your body unresponsive. The treatment for this disorder is knowledge. As noted, he says, in Science of Sleep, you simply need to be educated about what's happening so that you can calmly ride out the episode, which typically will not last more than a few minutes." Then he says, all of these stages are important, and it's important to cycle through them enough times each night, especially the deeper stages. When stages three and four are missing or interrupted, your brain gets clogged with debris associated with Alzheimer's disease, and indeed, sleep deprivation is a risk factor for severe dementia. Stages one through four are also what allow you to feel refreshed in the morning, while stage five is important for memory. And so again, this is why sleep is so, so very important. He goes on to say, "Well, the foregoing REM sleep for extended periods of time may also lead," he says, "to a state where you actually start dreaming while you're awake, resulting in delusions and wild hallucinations." He quotes the Science of Sleep. He says, "Science of Sleep features Dr. William DeMint, a professor of psychiatry and behavior sciences at Stanford, who in 1963 oversaw a sleep deprivation experiment by a young man named Randy Garner." And he says, quote, "We were waiting to see if he would become psychotic," DeMint says. "Garner stayed awake for a record 264 hours, 63 hours longer than Peter Tripp, a disc jockey who in 1959 tried to break the world record for sleeplessness. Tripp stayed awake for 201 hours straight during a continuous broadcast from Times Square. For Tripp, hallucinations set in on day three. He saw spiders in his shoes and became desperately paranoid, convinced people were trying to poison him. He became convinced that people were actually trying to poison him. He also became belligerent and abusive and, according to one of the attending psychiatrists, clearly psychotic. Gardner, on the other hand, claims he was feeling all right up until the eighth or ninth day and didn't start having hallucinatory experiences until the very end. Once the experiment ended, after 11 days of wakefulness followed by 14 hours of sleep, a comprehensive exam and mental health check was performed. Gardner was found to be completely normal. According to DeMint, Gardner's experiment proved extended sleep loss did not cause psychosis. Tripp's experiment, on the other hand, revealed that even though he was awake, walking around and talking, his brain waves showed he was asleep, and it was during the REM cycle that he was most likely to hallucinate. Essentially, he was experiencing his nightmares in an awake state. So amazing. He goes on to say, what's more, while Tripp had no signs of psychosis after the experiment ended and he slept for 24 hours, many insisted his personality had permanently changed for the worse. He was no longer as cheerful and easygoing as he'd been before, and those who knew him best insist those 8 days of sleep deprivation damaged his psyche long term. In all likelihood, the effects of sleep deprivation will affect different people in different ways, depending on a variety of biological, environmental, and perhaps even genetic factors. So imagine that. The first guy, although his sleep deprivation affected him in a more acute way, if you would. Tripp, the second guy, although he appeared to have no signs of psychosis, those who knew him said he was not the same, and they believed that his personality had been permanently damaged by lack of sleep, which no doubt permanently damaged his psyche or his brain. Again, this is very, very amazing when we look at how important sleep is. And remember, when I talk about the laws of health and I talk about the scientific application, I frequently talk about how important the laws of health are. You hear me talk about how first is trust in the Creator. And then, and then we talk about the importance of sunshine, exercise, water, air, rest, diet, and temperance or self-control. Sleep falls under the health law of rest. And so, again, this is why when I say that there are, you cannot improve upon those health laws, you can't improve upon them, and they're crucial. We need to understand how crucial they are. Now, as we try to wrap up this particular article, because we need to move on to our next segment, he goes on to say, sleep deprivation can be worsened by jet lag, also known as flight fatigue, time zone change syndrome. Jet lag occurs when travel across time zones disrupt your internal body clock, resulting in daytime sleepiness and lethargy, nighttime insomnia, irritability, confusion, and poor concentration. Interestingly, he says, researchers have found that people with a genetically inherited sleep disorder called familiar advanced sleep phase syndrome have a circadian body clock that runs about 3 hours faster than normal. According to Sleep Science of Sleep, scientists are trying to determine the protein associated with this gene in the hope that it might be helped to develop jet lag drugs. Of course, we are not interested in drugs doing that. Of course, we would like to be able to find a natural way to do it, but that's just what he was pointing out in this article. Finally, he says that he gives some general sleep guidelines. And so he says, how much sleep do you need to optimize your mental and physical health? According to a scientific review of more than 300 studies published between 2004 and 2014, a panel of experts came up with the following recommendations. And he points out, keep in mind that if you're sick, injured, or pregnant, you may need a bit more than normal. But here are the recommendations. Newborns, 0 to 3 months, they need 14 to 17 hours. Infants, 4 to 11 months, 12 to 15 hours. Toddlers, 1 to 2 years, 11 to 14 hours. Preschoolers, 3 to 5 years, 10 to 13 hours. School-age children, 6 to 13, 9 to 11 hours. Teenagers, 14 to 17, 8 to 10 hours. Adults, 18 to 64, 7 to 9 hours. Seniors, 65 and older, 7 to 8 hours. And so again, those are guidelines. And as he pointed out, if a woman is pregnant or if you're sick, you will need a little bit more than that, as you know. When you don't feel everybody tells you, you know, it makes you want to lie down anyway and to get rest. Again, you're listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry, on the Phase 3 Wellness podcast. We're going to pivot over now to our – we have about 16 minutes left in our broadcast. We're going to pivot over now to our healing food, which is mangoes. And today I want to take some of the information about healing foods from the Natural Health 365 site. And basically, I want to talk about the benefit, mainly of how mangoes can help the body. Now, mangoes, again, is one of my favorite foods, packed with so many minerals and vitamins and nutrients. We won't go into the details of those like I normally do, because I want to just talk about some of the real-world benefits of a mango. Mangoes have been found to have a positive effect on high blood pressure readings as well as elevated glucose levels. And so if you have blood sugar issues, diabetes, or hypertension, mangoes may be in your future if you're not already eating them. In fact, a recent study out of the University of California, Davis, found that eating mangoes is beneficial to both your stomach as well as your heart. The researchers did confirm in this study that eating mangoes can actually lower your blood pressure naturally. But the study, they took postmenopausal women, and these women consumed 2 mango servings, which is roughly 330 grams per day, every day, for 2 weeks, for 14 days. And they actually used honey mango, which was the mango used in this particular study, due to his high, because it has high concentration of polyphenols. Measurements were taken regularly, including blood pressure, the heart rate, blood samples, as well as a breath measurement. After 14 days, the women resumed a normal diet but did not eat mango for 13 days. The researchers found that eating 2 servings of mangoes per day brought significant systolic, that's the top number, blood pressure benefits for otherwise healthy postmenopausal women. And consuming the fruit regularly was found to actually relax blood vessel constriction in just 2 hours in some cases. So it's amazing that in some cases, after just 2 hours of eating the mango, the honey mango, there was blood vessel constriction was lessened in some cases. It went on to point out how some, in this study, it was also found that some participants showed positive changes to their levels of methane, which can be measured to determine the level of gut fermentation. As again, this is indicative that, or it implies that the digestive balance or the gut microbe benefits that can be attained as well from mangoes. So again, because fruits and vegetables eaten in their natural state are high in fiber, so they're always going to benefit, and other, as well as other nutrients, they're always going to benefit the gut for the most part. They also found in this study that eating mangoes are a highly effective way to help lower blood pressure and diabetes. So the findings of positive stomach and vascular benefits from eating these mangoes actually was built on other research about the health effects of mangoes, including cellular as well as animal studies. Because they're, again, mangoes are rich in a number of what they call polyphenols, including quercetin. You've heard me talk about that on here before, mangiferin, gallic acid, and gallotannins. Again, these compounds are associated with a protective effect on the cells of your body. So it's in line with the moniker, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. Now, although mangoes contain natural sugar, they also have an undeniable effect on regulating blood sugar as well as your glucose levels. And so this actually can hold promise for those who are suffering from diabetes or pre-diabetes. In fact, there was a study published in Nutrition and Metabolic Insights, and they found in this study point out how eating mangoes decrease fasting blood glucose levels in obese persons. Again, there was a British study of mice from 2011, and this study found that same effect on glucose levels as well as a positive effect on cholesterol. And in this study with this mice, this 2011 study in Britain, the mice, not only did their cholesterol improve and their blood glucose improve, but they also lost weight. This is also, again, seen to have similar effects on human beings. In the human study, there were 20 obese persons, and they ate 10 grams of freeze-dried ground mango daily for 3 months. A control group did not. Those who ate mango demonstrated a significant drop in their blood glucose levels. In males, hip circumference decreased. However, body weight and composition stayed the same. So again, those are some of the amazing benefits of eating mangoes. So if you or someone you know or love has issues with their blood pressure or their blood sugar, they really should consider involving mangoes in the right amounts of mangoes, and eating the right amounts of mangoes and helping them with, in some cases, with their weight, with their blood sugar, and also with their blood pressure. So again, healing food is mangoes. Who would have thought that a fruit that tastes so good can also be so beneficial in helping us deal with our blood sugar as well as our blood pressure? And again, if you didn't get all of those numbers and amounts, those studies, you can just listen to the podcast again. It'll be available typically about no more than 10 minutes after I'm done here on Blog Talk Radio, and maybe probably 45 minutes afterward. We basically publish it on several different platforms. So way Facebook, YouTube, whatever. Or you can go back to Blog Talk Radio from this platform that we're using to broadcast, and you can listen to it from there, pass it around, take notes. And remember, many times when you get sick or not feeling well, if you go back and take notes in these things and keep a notebook, you'll find you may be able to implement some of these, some of the information that we talk about here, and not only when you get sick, but even beforehand, because an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So now we'll flip over to our final segment, which is the Healing Herb segment. You are listening to the Phase 3 Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I am a naturopathic doctor based in Orlando, Florida. And so we're going to go now over to our Healing Herb segment. And in this segment, we're going to be talking about lavender. And lavender, with the emergence and popularity of essential oils, most people have heard of lavender, and they think of lavender with respect to oils. But most of the oils are taken from herbs. So let's look a little bit at lavender. Lavender is actually a very, very beneficial herb, whether you use it in a powder form or you use it in a loose form, if you use it in an oil form. It's interesting that I want to give a quote here before I start. This is from the prescription for herbal healing, talking about lavender. It says, a compound tincture of lavender known as palsy drops was officially recognized by the British Pharmacia for over 200 years. It was used to relieve muscle spasms, nervousness, and headaches. And so this is a backdrop. So the essential oil, when you're looking at lavender, is powerful. But let's look at some of the other things. We'll get to the essential oil in a minute. What has lavender been used for? Lavender has been used as a general tonic, as a sedative over the years, for centuries. It's been used as a general tonic. It's been used as a sedative, as an antispasmodic, as for spasming. It's been used as a diuretic, as a digestive aid. It's been used as a remedy for gas. Many times you'll see lavender tea or lavender essential oil prescribed to treat common minor ailments such as insomnia and nervousness, fatigue, headache, nausea, and also alleviate depression. The essential oil of lavender has also antiseptic qualities as well, and it's actually be able to kill several types of disease-causing bacteria. So this is why you'll see the oil oftentimes. The essential oil has been used to treat skin ailments like the fungus and burns and for the skin. People may have been burned. It's been used for wounds. It's been used for eczema, acne. And so again, when we look at lavender, it has a very, very interesting and a beneficial background. Give me just a second here. I have a call coming in. Give me just a second here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Caller?
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay. I'm doing okay. How you doing?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just called in. I looked at the topic, seemed interesting, so I just started listening.
Oh, so did you? Okay. If you just got in and didn't catch the first part of when I was talking about how the stresses of the father can be passed along to his offspring, the entire show will be available at about 5 minutes after I go off air. So I'm going to be going off air in about 6 minutes. So if you want to get back and listen to that first part, you'll be able to do so in probably about 10 minutes if you missed the part about how the stresses of the father can be passed along to his offspring.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. I think that could be done through generation, even mother to daughter, if they having fibroids, the stress of, you know, whether if they was family lineage dealing all the way back through slavery, if they haven't healed through that time period, it can just keep passing down. So I do, I'm definitely going to check that out. But I do agree with that. It can happen on father to the son and to the mother to the daughter also, I believe. So
That's correct. Okay. Okay. Thank you for calling in.
All right.
And again, just anyone else who may be listening as well, just as I was telling our caller, about 5 minutes after I go off air, the presentation will will process and it'll be available. And you can go back and listen to the first part of the broadcast where I dealt with a recent study that came out showing how the stresses of the father can be passed along to his offspring genetically. And as the caller pointed out, and as I pointed out briefly, also with the mother, it's going to be because we can cause changes in our DNA through stress, through the way we eat, through the way and it can be passed down, you know, throughout. Unless it's corrected, it's going to manifest itself. And so again, those who didn't catch that part, I highly recommend that you check it out, go back and listen, and you can even read the article that I referred to in that particular segment. So again, we're in the final segment now, and we're talking about how you can use lavender again and how it's been used. Now, one of the ways it's been used for headache, it's been used for acne and psoriasis, because lavender actually has the ability to stop pain caused by headaches and as well as various skin conditions through the action of two compounds that's actually found in the essential oil. One of these compounds is called linalool, and the other is called linalool aldehyde. And linalool, what it does is it increases the threshold of pain. In other words, meaning that a stronger stimulus is required before you actually feel the pain. In addition to stopping the perception of pain, the lavender also inhibits the hormonal reactions that create inflammation and pain. So here we have a oil, an essential oil in this case, that the creator has made to help to ease pain and inflammation. And typically when you can deal with it does it by two ways. Like I said, first it can do it by increasing basically your pain tolerance, essentially. And secondarily, by stopping the perception of pain, it inhibits the hormonal reactions that create inflammation and pain. Now, it also has been used and has been shown to be beneficial for anxiety and insomnia. So the use of lavender oil in aromatherapy for sleep problems was verified by investigators in a six-week study actually involving nursing home residents. Now, in this particular study, researchers found that when they perfumed the sleeping ward with lavender and lavender oil for 2 weeks, the residents slept as long as and more soundly than they did during a different two-week interval in which they took sleep-inducing drugs. So think about that. Lavender worked better than sleeping drugs that they were giving these people in the nursing home who apparently were not getting enough sleep, who were not able to sleep. Not only the quality of sleep, but the quantity of sleep, as I talked about in the last segment, or the first segment, rather, when we were talking about sleep and the benefits of sleep. Lavender has also been used for bronchitis, burns, discomfort and gas, and also for yeast infections. Now, interesting, it was used in bronchitis. I'm not going to be able to talk about it in the detail because I'm running out of time. So I'm going to pick one of these and say, let's talk about how it was used in bronchitis. Now, there was a study. There were some Russian physicians that they were faced with a severe shortage of medicine, and so they refined the use of lavender oil in the treatment of chronic bronchitis. Now, I know a lot of people suffer from bronchitis, and so you always have to consider the cause of the bronchitis. But in the meantime, you can deal with the symptoms. But in this, what these Russian physicians found, they refined the use of lavender oil, and what they did in trying to treat these people who had chronic bronchitis. And so, patients, what they did was they used the oil for patients to breathe vapors from lavender oil for 30 minutes a day over several days to several weeks, and their bronchial symptoms lessened. There were also other studies have confirmed that at least in the American variety of lavender oil, it was able to reduce the severity of bronchitis by acting as an antihistamine. So imagine that. So again, lavender is one of the ideal herbs that we're talking about. And again, as I said earlier, herbs can be used in several different ways. When you're using them as an essential oil, that's the most powerful way you have. You can use herbs as extracts, as powders, as teas, etc. But the strongest form, the most concentrated form you're going to use them in is in the oil form, essential oil. But that's not the only way that you can use them, and that's not the only way that they can be effective. Again, you have been listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless. And remember, this episode will be available in about probably about 5 to 7 minutes after I go off air. If you didn't catch it at the beginning, feel free to go back and catch it from the beginning. Again, thank you for listening. God bless.